Accurate information is everything, and now coronavirus researchers around the world are learning more about what's happening inside China.
So there was actually a Chinese government paper put out yesterday, and this actually was the first real good glimpse into what the severity is really looking like.
Also today, Jeff Bezos made a splash with his promise to spend $10 billion to slow down global warming. But what does $10 billion really get you? We look at what environmentalists say is needed to bend the curve on climate change. And in Ireland, a story worthy of a sea shanty.
Wrecks like this were thought to be a thing of the past, that you would never see something so big end up on the shore.
A ghost ship drifts into view, plus snails and the cosmetics industry that love them. The stories ahead on the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Thanks for being here today. Along with the coronavirus outbreak centered in China comes a ton of information. The World Health Organization coined it an infodemic. So we start today with a reality check on what we know and what scientists are trying to learn. Dr. Michael Minna is an infectious disease specialist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He says a month ago, about 300 people were confirmed to have COVID-19. This week, that number is more than 17,000 cases.
Well, it's following the expected spread for a virus like this. It seems to be doubling every 4 or 5 days.
But lately, Minna says the spread in China has been slowing down.
So I would say from an epidemiological perspective, it's actually followed the characteristic dynamics that we would have anticipated.
And for an epidemiologist, is that a concern that it's following the predicted spread?
It is. For a virus like this, we know that the predicted spread is going to be exponential. And so that's because every individual who becomes symptomatic and spreads it spreads to, in this case, more than one person. And so that suggests that we want to try to contain this as quickly as possible before it gets entirely out of control.
How contagious is this disease?
Normally, I'm studying measles. And so for me personally, I think that this is it's not the most contagious or transmissible pathogen that we are normally concerned of as humans. But given the severity that seems to be occurring, it seems to be maybe spreading a little bit more rapidly than an influenza virus, for example. So I think it's quite disturbing how quickly it's spreading.
Dr. Minna, what have you been learning about the severity of the actual illness from the coronavirus, and who is most at risk?
Yeah, so there was actually a Chinese government paper put out yesterday, and this actually was the first real good glimpse into what the severity is really looking like across ages. And as anticipated from what we've heard, it's very much a virus that's affecting more severely the elderly and really individuals over 40, but particularly over 60 or 70. We've seen in children very, very few, even case reports, no less, very small numbers of actual severe cases or deaths. So overall, it seems to be tracking around 2% overall, but in particular in adults.
So 2% fatality rate overall.
Of reported cases.
Of reported cases.
Yeah. And that is a very important distinction because there's a very good likelihood that there's actually very large numbers of people in China currently who are potentially completely asymptomatic or so mild that they're not being reported at all. And I personally think the real numbers of people who have acquired the virus might be over a million in China. If it really is a million, that actually would bring down the overall case fatality rate quite significantly.
So as countries around the world prepare for the possible spread of COVID-19, there's this big question about how to test for it, whether labs are set up and ready. How do you test for it? And how would that happen in the U.S. or even at your hospital, Brigham and Women's?
Yeah, the major test that the world has been basing all these confirmed cases on is a PCR, a molecular test, where we actually look for little bits of the viral genome. And that's because this tool is very, very sensitive to pick up viruses.
And how is that test working?
So, well, we haven't had any patients, thankfully, to test it on in Brigham, and we're actually just starting to get it set up. The CDC actually is currently really taking responsibility. They're supposed to be taking responsibility anyway for all of the testing that's being performed in the United States. They had created these test kits, which went out to all the public health labs across the United States. And unfortunately, there was a hiccup, and it's still not fully clear what really went wrong there. but the test kits didn't work. So sort of all the tests that need to be done are currently still being done at CDC, and hopefully they'll get new test kits out to the state labs in the near future.
And finally, treatments. China has dozens of clinical trials now underway, from what I understand, to test different treatments. What do you see as promising right now? Or maybe should I say, what is the reality of finding treatments and even a vaccine for this illness?
I think that the idea of finding a vaccine is probably higher than finding a really curative treatment that's going to sort of cure anyone who gets severe disease. We would all love to find a really good antiviral therapy that we can give to somebody in critical care. We'll just have to see how those clinical studies turn out. In terms of vaccines, there's, of course, been a huge flurry of activity of companies trying to develop new modern vaccines. And I do feel confident that these will come out. I think it's just a matter of time. My guess is they won't become widely available, at least until, you know, late summer, if not a year from now.
Dr. Michael Minna, an infectious disease specialist at Harvard and at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We know you have questions about COVID-19, and Michael Minna is ready to answer them. Tomorrow, Wednesday, we're holding a Facebook Live session with him and Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Start dropping in your questions now on the World's Facebook page and join us tomorrow at noon Eastern Time. There's a money laundering story connected to coronavirus, not the kind of money laundering from that scene in Office Space.
To conceal the source of money as by channeling it through an intermediary. To conceal the source of money.
Doesn't really help us, Michael.
I can't believe what a bunch of nerds we are. We're looking up money laundering in a dictionary.
We're talking literally laundering money. In China, banks are cleaning their cash to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Ultraviolet light or high temperatures are used to disinfect renminbi banknotes, the Chinese currency. Then they actually store the cash for up to 2 weeks before putting it back into circulation. For some cities, though, even that's not enough. China's central bank in Guangzhou announced that it would destroy banknotes that come from hospitals, farmers markets, and buses. That might be an overabundance of caution, says Emily Martin. She's an epidemiologist at the University of Michigan.
So there's very little evidence that viruses, particularly respiratory viruses, will survive on surfaces and on bills in a way that allows them to go on and infect additional people. You may be able to detect the DNA or the RNA of these viruses on surfaces and on bills, but for coronaviruses, there's just not a lot of data that suggests that that virus that you're picking up on a surface or perhaps on a bill would actually have the capacity to infect somebody else.
Now, there's no doubt about this. Banknotes are kind of gross. They do pick up all sorts of bacteria. A study of dollar bills in New York turned up almost 400 different types of microbes.
You know, we've got bacteria and viruses all around us, like on all of our surfaces. So if you look for it, you're going to find it. You know, if you look for the DNA and the RNA for these pathogens anywhere in your environment, you're going to find stuff.
A sobering thought. Still, Martin says, before you decide to go fully cashless, keep this in mind about the new coronavirus.
It really appears that most of the transmission that's happening is not through direct contact, but it's through people breathing in sort of droplets that have virus in the air.
As always, facts matter. Every 30 seconds in the United States, a young Latino turns 18 and becomes eligible to vote. We're checking in with some of these young voters in the run-up to the election with our reporting project, Every 30 Seconds. Stella Chavez is a reporter with KERA in Dallas.
Hi, Marco.
So a lot happening in Texas. Super Tuesday is 2 weeks from today. A lot of people focused on that big primary day, and Texas delegates are up for grabs on Super Tuesday. Why is Texas so important to candidates?
Texas is still a red state, especially in the rural areas. Now, the larger urban areas like Dallas and Houston, they're very much blue. And young Latinos and Latinos overall, they're a key demographic group for candidates hoping to win those seats. About 30% of eligible voters in Texas are Latino. And to tap into that group, different organizations in Texas are mobilizing to get young Latinos engaged in the electoral process.
What are those groups and organizations doing to reach out?
Here's an example. I recently attended a forum where presidential candidates could talk to young Latino voters. It was organized by a group called JOLT, which calls itself the largest progressive Latino organization in Texas. And their mission is to empower young Latinos. You can hear that in their slogan, which I heard during the event.
We are brown, black, and powerful.
We are brown, black, and powerful.
And we won't back down.
And we won't back down.
Wow, some serious energy there.
Definitely. Jolt wants candidates to stop prioritizing places like Iowa and New Hampshire, which don't really reflect the demographics of other parts of the country. And they want them to refocus on more representative areas of the country like Texas or Nevada. I spoke with Antonio Arellano, who is Jolt's interim executive director.
Any candidate that underestimates and does not prioritize young Latino voters is making a very serious mistake. You see, the growing political power in Texas is incredibly young, and it's Latino. And so if you want to win the state of Texas, you've got to start listening to Latino voices, specifically Latina women.
Yeah, and if you don't listen, he says, it's a very serious mistake. Why the focus on Latina specifically?
Arellano points to a 2018 study of young Latino voters that found Latinas register and vote at higher rates than Latinos. And that gender difference is especially notable among younger Latinos. He says Latinas lead the way in Latino families, so they're the ones nurturing and protecting their children, and that take-charge mentality spills over to the polls.
So you met some young Latinos at that town hall. What are they saying about the upcoming election?
The vast majority of the people at this event don't support Donald Trump and his policies like on immigration, the detention camps along the border, or remain in Mexico. And that's where migrants seeking asylum are sent to Mexico to wait for their day in court instead of waiting with loved ones in the U.S. But young Latinos are also worried about other issues like college affordability. I met Ronolfo Alvarado. He's 19 and he's from Splendora, Texas. And he goes to Stephen F. Austin University, where he's studying political science. He told me one of the biggest issues for him in 2020 will be student debt.
If the government can actually fund a higher education, maybe people will go into colleges or trade schools to get a better job and to live a better life.
I heard from students concerned about the cost of health care and medical debt, too.
In Texas, Stella, is there a sense that Latinos, especially young Latinos, may help tip the scales when it comes to the election?
Well, that depends. If every Latino that's eligible to vote shows up, and particularly younger Latinos, it's important to note, Marco, that some Latinos in Texas voted for Trump, and they continue to support him. So Latino turnout could potentially change the outcome. At least that's what groups like Jolt think. But the question is, will they actually show up? And that's always the question.
Yeah, isn't it? Stella Chavez, a reporter at KERA in Dallas, will be checking in with her over the course of the year as she reports on young Latino voters with our project every 30 seconds. Stella, thanks very much for this.
Thank you, Marco.
It took a while to confirm the result, but 5 months after Afghanistan went to the polls, Ashraf Ghani has been declared the winner of the presidential election there. That's Hawa Alam Nuristani, the head of the Election Commission, announcing the results in Kabul today. Ghani's main opponent, Abdullah Abdullah, alleged vote rigging in the September election, which led to the delay in confirming the results. Ghani spoke in Kabul today. We want peace, a lasting peace, he said, and promised that his team will deliver it to all of Afghanistan. Ghani's re-election comes as the U.S., the Taliban, and the Afghan government are trying to agree on terms that will end the 18-year war in Afghanistan. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Protests and legal challenges did not stop the British government from deporting a group of Jamaican nationals back to Jamaica last week. They had each been convicted of crimes in the United Kingdom. But as the BBC's Greg McKenzie reports from Kingston, many of them lived in the UK for so long that they're struggling to adapt to life in a country they hardly know.
On board this latest deportation flight, there were 17 individuals who'd committed various crimes, including 33-year-old Rupert Smith, a first-time offender. He left behind a wife and three children.
There's a system in place where they categorize you as low or high risk, but they don't follow that categorization business. What they do is they come for you on the basis of what the crime is that you committed. You get what I mean? If they think that you are of threat to them, they will put you in one of them suits where your arms are strapped to your chest.
Like a straitjacket.
Yeah, you're shackled by the feet, one to an officer on the left, one to an officer on the right. There were 17 detainees and 167 officers. So they have full control of everything you do.
Some of the men have been helped by local volunteers, but many found themselves left to fend for themselves. 2 hours from the capital, I meet 24-year-old Chevron Brown in St. Anne's. He arrived in the UK from Jamaica at the age of 14. He was deported in February last year after a string of driving offences.
The last year has been really terrifying and kind of depressing, really. Stressful being out here and not having no connections, being able to move forward with actually what you need to do to get back your life. It's actually been very difficult because of the stigma that's on my name.
At a barbershop here in Kingston, the deportation flight and the deportees is the main topic of conversation.
It's just really, really hard for someone to leave a country so young and then adapt to another country and a whole different lifestyle. I think it's going to have a huge mental strain on that person, honestly.
Jamaica was a British colony until the country became independent in 1962 and still maintains strong ties with Britain. Pastor Desmond Jaddo from Birmingham in the UK is on the island trying to help these men.
The first thing, we're hearing of people who have been deported, who have been in the UK for anything up to 30, 35 years. If they've been in there that long, it's very difficult to come back here and start from scratch. And, I mean, the stress that these guys are going to be under, because, importantly, they're away from their families, children, and young children as well. Remember, these people have now been stigmatized as being dangerous criminals. And I know of people who have gone for jobs and been told, your accent is a British one. I don't know who you are, but if you came in on that flight, we're not going to employ you because you're a dangerous criminal.
They took us off the plane, the police camp. They gave us food to eat, drink. The most they offered us was a phone call. That was it. No money, no nothing. If it weren't other people that's been hearing about everything that's been going on and taking individual interest, like a lot of us will be most probably sleeping on the road right now.
A resident here in Jamaica, Carmeletti Campbell, has strong views about what should happen to the deportees.
They have nowhere to live, no money, no nothing. So why are they sending them here? I think that they should keep them in Britain.
While the UK Home Office says it doesn't comment on individual cases, it has defended the deportations, making no apology whatsoever for seeking to remove what it says are dangerous foreign criminals from Britain.
The BBC's Greg McKenzie reporting there from Kingston, Jamaica. In Turkey, it has been a roller coaster of a day for opposition activists. It began with the surprise acquittal of a group of protest leaders. They had been facing charges of seeking to overthrow the government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. There wasn't much time to celebrate, though. Hours later, an arrest warrant was issued for the most prominent of them, a man called Osman Kavala. Reporter Ayla Jean Yakli is in Istanbul. So I gather Osman Kavala has been in detention for more than 2 years. Just who is he?
Osman Kavala is one of Turkey's most important civil society figures. Maybe Turks on the street have never heard of him, but within civil society circles, he's very well known. He's been involved in everything from cultural heritage preservation to promoting dialogue between Turks and Armenians and Turks and Kurds. He's a very significant person in those realms.
So what happened in court this morning in Istanbul?
So, as you said, it was a surprising decision. These 16 activists who were accused of organizing a 2013 environmental protest as a cover to topple the government were acquitted. And it was surprising because the court proceedings had been so stacked against them. And politicians, including the all-powerful President Tayyip Erdogan, had labeled them guilty before they were even tried. So people went to court today, observers, friends, and families, expecting a guilty verdict.
So they did not get that guilty verdict this morning. It was an acquittal. How did the defendants and their supporters react to that surprise?
The reaction was one of shock, but also of joy. There were tears as well as rounds of applause. And a group of supporters of Osman Kavala, as well as politicians, including opposition members of parliament, stayed on at this prison campus about an hour and a half outside of Istanbul to welcome Osman Kavala after his release. He was the only suspect being held in detention, and it's been more than 2.5 years. And they were expecting to essentially receive him and bring him home. They were informed while they were waiting that a prosecutor had essentially reopened a new an old case into his alleged role in a 2016 failed coup attempt by the military.
Are these different charges now?
These are different charges. In 2016, a faction of the military attempted an outright coup against President Erdogan and failed. And over the last 4 years, close to 4 years, 3.5 years, more than 130,000 people have been dismissed from state jobs. 70,000 people have been arrested in connection with that effort. It's blamed on a Muslim cleric named Fethullah Gulen, who is actually living in Pennsylvania. Osman Kavala had been linked to that through a prosecution, but there is no indictment. There's not a lot of details. The evidence that we have so far is quite flimsy, but somehow connecting him to that plot. Mm.
Is there any plausibility to these various allegations against Osman Kavala?
It's really difficult to see any. The court case in which he was just acquitted, there was a scarcity of evidence. He was accused of bankrolling the 2013 environmental protests, and that allegation centered around him buying pastries for protesters. So it's really difficult to see any kind of strong case against him.
That's reporter Ayla Jean Yackley in Istanbul. You're listening to The World. Police in Western China are using surveillance technology like scannable codes on people's front doors.
The police can have your identification number, your name, your age, every information they want.
The crackdown on Muslim Uyghurs in China, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. The richest man in the world is stepping up to fight what he calls the biggest threat to our world. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos says he's going to start handing out $10 billion worth of grants to fight climate change this summer. The money will go to scientists, activists, and NGOs. Beyond that, it's not clear how Bezos will spend that money. So our environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, looked at some possibilities.
$10 billion is about 8% of Jeff Bezos' estimated net worth. That sounds like a lot of money. But up against climate change, not so much. The UN estimates greening the global economy would cost more than $1 trillion every year.
So $10 billion is really quite a lot of money. But in terms of what governments are spending every day, it's small.
This is Gavin Schmidt, head of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies.
So if you want it to really make a big difference, you need to be investing it in projects that are going to lead to more investment or enabling like new technologies.
When I asked Schmidt how he would spend the $10 billion, he pulled a NASA and emailed me an itemized list. It starts with new satellites and supercomputers and a new center to help translate climate science into policy, all for the low, low price of just $440 million. Then come the big ticket items.
R&D into smart grid technologies, modular nuclear power, large scale storage. Those are huge areas that are ripe for investment.
Energy expert Dan Shreve says shifting the entire United States to renewable energy would cost a whopping $4.5 trillion. So if you only have billions to spend, he says you get the most bang for your buck from spending on researching key emerging technologies, starting with batteries.
Specifically, long duration, large scale renewable energy storage.
Storage for solar and wind power exists, of course, but not at the scale that would allow a massive shift away from coal and gas.
We need to think bigger. We need to think much, much bigger. And we have to start talking about storage able to deliver power for many, many hours, or in some cases, many days, and doing so in very large power ratings. So we're talking hundreds of megawatts, not single digit or tens of megawatts.
Experts point to Germany's experience. Huge public investment in renewable energy changed the landscape there. But it also helped make solar panels cheap enough globally to spur their use around the world. Bangladeshi climate policy expert Salim Ul-Haq would advise Jeff Bezos to spend his money somewhere else, though.
Well, I would say the highest priority from my perspective is supporting the poorest and most vulnerable people on the planet.
Only a small amount of the money being spent on climate change goes to adaptation. That means protecting people from the damage caused by things like rising seas and stronger storms.
And if Mr. Bezos really wants to make a difference, he should correct that imbalance.
In Bangladesh, Huck suggests paying for rainwater collection systems for places where salty seawater is rising and ruining drinking water sources, or more salt-resistant rice to plant. No matter how he spends his money, Jeff Bezos will likely keep getting criticized for his own climate record. Elizabeth Jardim at Greenpeace says Bezos is speaking out of both sides of his mouth right now.
On the one hand, he's making these bold statements to address climate change. And on the other, his company is continuing to support the oil and gas industry with contracts to extract oil and gas more quickly with machine learning. And its own carbon footprint is growing every day.
Jardim says Amazon has the largest network of energy-sucking data centers in the world, and all those overnight Prime deliveries don't help either. It was a group of Amazon employees whose protests are thought to have helped inspire the $10 billion promise from Bezos. They welcomed the announcement, but say that one hand cannot give while the other takes away. The group is urging Bezos to help his own company go green while doing the same around the world. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is on a diplomatic mission to Africa this week. He's visiting Senegal, Angola, and Ethiopia. The U.S. is looking to counter the influence of Russia and China across the African continent, so development is high on the agenda, but so is the growing threat of extremist groups. The FBI has just set up its first counterterrorism task force in Kenya. Jeff Porter is the president of North Africa Risk Consulting. I asked him how significant this new joint terrorism task force really is.
I think there's a broader shift in policy in the U.S. government to transfer some of the burden of counterterrorism away from U.S. assets, whether that's the FBI or the U.S. military, and to our foreign partners through what the U.S. government calls partner capacity building programs. The JTTF that the FBI recently helped establish is in fact going to be staffed by Kenyan government officials. And what the FBI is doing is transferring expertise in creating JTTFs and helping them understand the counterterrorism process. So it should alleviate some of the counterterrorism burden taken on by the United States in East Africa and transfer that to Kenyan counterparts.
So in addition to the announcement of the joint terrorism task forces in Kenya, we've got this report from the Pentagon Inspector General, came out recently. It says the security situation is deteriorating, not just in East Africa, but also in the Sahel and West Africa. Late last year, the U.S. Africa Command said that the new U.S. military strategy had switched from trying to get rid of these extremist groups to trying to contain them from spreading. What is the scope of the threat from these extremist groups right now? What do you make of this new containment strategy?
The big question, I think, being debated right now in Congress and in the Pentagon is, to what degree does the growing terrorism threat in West Africa and the Sahel pose a direct risk to national security interests? And so one of the things that we're seeing play out in real time is policy vacillating back and forth as a reflection of that debate. You know, on the one hand, there's a sense that terrorism in West Africa and the Sahel, it doesn't pose a real direct threat to the homeland. So you can see a shift to a quote unquote containment policy. On the other hand, there is a school of thought which argues that allowing terrorist organizations to gestate in these areas will allow them to eventually pose a direct threat to national security interests. And it behooves the United States to try and get ahead of that. So we're seeing a vacillation in policy, and the result is kind of a muddled and incoherent approach to counterterrorism in West Africa and the Sahel.
And what about the humanitarian concern? Like, what happens in a country like Burkina Faso, which until a few years ago was a poor but peaceful country, now hundreds of thousands of refugees and lots of people getting killed by extremist groups? I mean, how is the United States supposed to assist there?
You know, we just finished the first decade of Africa Command, or AFRICOM, which was supposed to be a new approach to security issues in Africa. The foundations of AFRICOM were what they called the three Ds. It was going to be defense, diplomacy, and development. Ultimately, what happened was that the defense component of the three Ds completely dominated the other two, and diplomacy and development fell by the wayside. I know it's cliche, but when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And right now, the biggest hammer we have is the Department of Defense, which dwarfs, you know, the Department of State or USAID or any of the other agencies that would have the capacity to address the human security issues rather than strictly the terrorism issues.
Some people say the U.S. is taking resources out of Africa to counter Russia and China and other parts of the world. But my mind goes back to Trump's disparaging comments about African countries. And I'm just wondering, maybe does the White House not really care that much?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the truth. I mean, if you look at the travel ban, it disproportionately affects African countries. I've been working in West and North Africa for the last 20 years, and the U.S. is just not there. You know, we're not there. And it's astounding to see projects that typically would have been U.S. projects, infrastructure projects, military assistance, being done by the Chinese, the Russians, and the Turks. The U.S. is completely absent. There's all this discussion about the grand competition between the United States, Russia, China. And even if that were true, the United States is losing in Africa.
Jeff Porter, the president of North Africa Risk Consulting. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
In Thailand, like most places, snails have long been seen as pests that ruin crops. But there's a new cosmetics craze in Asia that's changing the snail's reputation. This particular beauty treatment is all about snail slime, which now puts these creatures in high demand. So much so that a kilo of snail slime powder can be as valuable as a kilo of gold. The World's Patrick Nguyen tracked down Thailand's top snail expert to find out more.
I'm in a laboratory in Bangkok with a scientist and a snail. And he's, how do I put it, stimulating the snail with a little plastic eyedropper. That's Professor Somsak Banha, a biologist. He's the snail guru in Thailand. Now watch, he says. It's about to get slippery. I tell him, oh, I see it. It's getting shiny. Yeah, he says, and this shiny slime coming out, this is the stuff people use. And by use, he means rubbing it all over your face. They say it makes wrinkles disappear, that the goopiness makes your skin super soft. So I ask, well, what if I just put a little around my eyes right now? But he stops me saying, no, look, it would work, but we should test for bacteria first. Thailand is snail heaven. It rains a lot, snails like wet places, and of the 600 species native to the country, more than 100 were discovered by Somsak and his team at a university called Chulalongkorn. This guy, he adores snails. He picks one up, it's as big as a tennis ball with a caramel-colored shell, and he says, have you ever seen a snail's nose? It takes me a second to figure out what I'm looking at.
Oh, and even jamuk, nose,
this hole just opens up near the slimy thing's head and pulsates. That's how it breathes, he says.
Wow.
Somsak seems, like, wistful. Because seeing this for the first time as a young man, a snail breathing, in and out, in and out, it was thrilling, he says. He's been studying them for almost 30 years. He loves that they're sensitive. Yes, he says, they can feel it when you touch their shell. And he loves that they're both male and female. He loves all of it. Until recently, obsessing over snails was a lonely pursuit. But then... That's an ad for a snail mucus-based beauty serum. In the last few years, across Asia, this has been a huge fad. SPF 30 from snail
secretion filtrate. 89% of snail trusica.
Jenny Sweet White Snail Serum ใหม่ เท่านั้น.
It's seen as a South Korean thing, because that's where it first got really popular. But Somsak is like, wait, my Thai snails have way better slime. He singled out a few species with really good mucus that makes your skin bouncy and soft, and that helped kick off this craze in Thailand, where people in the upcountry now like to harvest snail slime as a side hustle. YouTube has lots of how-to videos like this, a Thai woman feeding rice to all of her snails, which live inside old car tires. You can scrape the slime off and sell it to cosmetics factories. Apparently, the money can be quite good. But Somsak says you gotta scrape a lot of slime to come out ahead. And look, he says, a snail can make a lot of slime. After all, it leaves a sticky trail everywhere it goes. But in one day, you might be able to extract 5 cubic centimeters. Some quick math here. To fill a pint glass with slime, it would take 3 months. Somsak himself makes and sells serum, and his operation churns out 1 ton of slime per year, he says, and that uses tens of thousands of snails. His company sells a little glass jar of slime for about $45. Business is good, he says, especially now that men have gotten into snail slime beauty treatments too. Men now buy more slime than women, he says. Now, I know he loves snails, but before I go, I have to ask. He says they feel every touch, right? So does all this poking and prodding and mucus collection, is it torturing them? No, he says. Add a bit of water when you gently scrape out the slime, and they'll be fine. He says, it's not torture, okay? People who roast them and eat them, that's way more harsh. Yes, the same species he identified as having grade A slime, people eat them too. And just as YouTube will teach you how to raise and feed snails, other videos will show you how to grill them. Real tasty, this YouTuber says. I asked the professor if he also thinks that they're tasty. I wouldn't know, he says. I've never eaten one in my life. I just don't have the heart to eat a snail. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok, Thailand.
The Chinese government is determined to root out perceived disloyalty among its Uyghur Muslim population. That's why authorities have rounded up hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs and other Muslims in Xinjiang province in western China. A newly leaked document sheds some light on who's being sent to the camps and why. Adrian Zenz is a scholar who studies Xinjiang. He says Muslims have been imprisoned simply because they applied for a passport, grew a beard, or wore a veil. Zenz says the documents also detail how the Chinese spy on the Uyghurs.
One of the most important insights of this new leaked document is how labor-intensive the re-education campaign is and how much of this information is gathered by teams often composed of Han Chinese government officials who are forced, often against their will, to visit Uyghur families, spend extensive amounts of time with them, even sleep with them, and get a personal information which they often then enter into a smartphone app.
Johar Ilham has been the victim of this kind of surveillance. She's the daughter of an imprisoned Uyghur scholar, Ilham Toti. Father and daughter were separated in 2013 at Beijing Airport as they prepared to travel to the U.S. Johar was 18 years old at the time. Chinese authorities sentenced her father to life in prison, and she hasn't seen him since.
I don't know where my father is. I don't know if he has been relocated to another prison. I don't know if he has been transferred to a camp. I don't even know if he's alive.
What has it been like for you living with that uncertainty? Because you lost contact with him in 2017. The last time you saw him, right, was 2013. What is that like?
Before coming to the U.S., I've never been apart from my family. Then I came here. I was able to Skype with my dad for 11 months before he was officially detained. We used to talk 3 times a day. We Skype 3 times a day, morning, noon, and night before we go to bed, just to make sure one of us is not suddenly taken away or killed. I still miss being able to talk to my family.
Are you outside of China on your own? Do you have other family members with you who are no longer there?
I am the only person in my family that were able to come to the U.S.
Johar, we've heard about China's use of mass surveillance to monitor and control everyone. Police on the street have access to a massive database that they can access through their handheld devices. Yes. If you're on the street in Western China and the police suspect you of something, how much can they learn about you?
Everyone has to give in their phones at the checkpoint, and there is one checkpoint every few blocks. Actually, my cousin, the daughter of my uncle, she was arrested a few years ago, arrested and sentenced to 10 years. They found my father's photo and his article in her phone. The police asked her, why do you have this terrorist information in your phone? And she said, he's my uncle. Why can't I have it? And that was the reason that she was sentenced to 10 years.
How common are examples like that?
It is very common. Families who are overseas, each person they have at least 1 to 10 family members are locked up in concentration camp. One of a young folk that I met a few weeks ago, he has 76 family members who are sent to concentration camps. People ask, what's the reason they've been sent? Can be any reason. It can be because the women can be dressing such a long skirt. That could be the reason. Maybe because you have a long beard. That could be a reason. Maybe you just simply hold a passport. That could be another reason. Or you talk to your family members overseas. That could be another reason.
We've also heard that some Uyghur homes in Xinjiang are required to have barcodes at the entrance. Is that true? And what data is embedded in those barcodes?
It's not some homes. It's almost every household has to do that. So any policeman, if they want to come and gather your information, it's like going to a Zara store. They go in front of the door and scan the QR code in front of your door, and the police can even have access to the electronic usage of your identification number, your name, your age, every information they want. And people, when they want to go back home, they have to scan it. When they go out, they have to scan it. So if there's other person visiting, you have to report it to the community center in order to have guests coming. And if you have too many guests coming, that's considered as a suspicious act.
And too many guests would suggest what to authorities?
Maybe you're gathered for discussing religious extremism. They could charge you for anything without an evidence.
Just as a reality check, I mean, do you wonder how many religious extremists there are among the Uyghur Muslims?
I don't know. But what the Chinese government is claiming, one is they are training people, teaching them skills to make them have a better life so they can have better incomes. They've learned how to fold sheets and put on pillowcases or wash clothes. So far, there are more than 1 million people. Do they all need to learn how to fold pillowcases, how to fold bed sheets? Some people have been detained are medical doctors and comedians, soccer players, singers, and professors. All of them have decent jobs. Are those people all extremists? Do they need vocational training? So I think what the Chinese government have been claiming, they're just excuses.
Uyghur activist Johar Ilham speaking with us from the 2020 Geneva Summit for Human Rights and Democracy, where she's one of the featured speakers. Johar, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Back in September of 2018, a 250-foot cargo ship was traveling from Greece to Haiti when it ran into major engine problems. The 10-person crew had to abandon ship. So the vessel was left adrift nearly 1,400 miles southeast of Bermuda. What happened next is unclear. No one was really looking for the ship, out of sight, out of mind, until a man named Barry McDonald went on a run along the cliffside in southern Ireland.
And as I ran out into the inlet there, the bay, it just came into view, just in a little cove, just a big ship. And I couldn't believe it. I was kind of astounded, confused.
The big ship had run aground near the fishing village of Ballycotton. McDonald assumed somebody already knew it was there. I mean, at 250 feet long, it'd be hard to miss.
I couldn't believe that I was the first person to see it, but I was. And I rang the Coast Guard. I actually said, you know, I presume you've got a call already, but I'm just checking. There's a big vessel on the rocks here. And he said, I'll just check now. And yeah, he said, no, we haven't heard anything. So he said, I'll get our local unit out. And they went down and had a look.
They did and concluded that the ship had spent the last 18 months making its way from Bermuda to the West African coast and up to the Celtic Sea, where stormy seas pushed the ship onto the rocky Irish coast. Owners of damaged or sunken ships are typically responsible for retrieving them, but McDonald, who volunteers on lifeboats himself, said this ship's owners probably didn't think they needed to.
I think that comes down to just the pure logistics of getting out to a vessel that's 1,500 miles offshore and trying to find it after it's been abandoned, how willing or interested the owners were in salvaging it and what the costs were.
Irish officials say there are no signs of pollution or safety risks. They are now waiting until low tide to determine what to do with the ship. In legend, though, she has probably sealed her folklore for years to come.
The sense around the place is wrecks like this were thought to be a thing of the past, that you would never see something so big end up on the shore. There has been a lot of talk of all the old wrecks over the years, and this seems to be a new addition to it, all right.
Yep, that's going to do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.